Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me?
Hey, Cheryl.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I have a kind of odd confession. It has to do with this letter that we're going to talk about. It's not exactly the same as the letter, but I kept thinking about this in my life, this thing that I do in my life, which I have not told a lot of people about, but now I'm going to tell you and whoever is listening. I, for many, many years, from the time I was very young, have been a shoplifter.
Really?
Yes. I take things that I have not paid for and put them into my pockets. And I've done this since I was very young.
What's the your first memory?
Old Barrel, going to the Old Barrel, stealing a couple of grape sticks, the Jolly Rancher grape sticks, and getting caught. And my dad caught me and was like, "Where did you get the money for that?" And of course, I was like, "Bah!" And, you know, immediately confessed and had to go and pay the guy and admit that I shoplifted, which you would think that should be enough. He will stop shoplifting. He's learned his lesson, but I did not. I continued to do it and have continued to do it until, you know, I can remember stealing deodorant in Miami in a grocery store and getting caught. And I was a journalist. I had a long sleeve shirt, button down shirt, you know, kind of fancy loafers. And like, I looked like a professional dude.
So this is like, how old are you?
Well, I was in my late 20s.
You got caught.
Yep.
Not your father, by the authorities.
Yeah.
For stealing deodorant.
I put it in my pocket.
What happened?
He just looked at me. I remember it was this guy, and he looked at me, and he was just like, "What the hell are you doing?" Because I was buying some groceries.
The hell were you doing?
Well, what I'm getting at, Cheryl, is I was acting something out over and over and over again. Uh-huh. Now, we're not going to talk about a letter that has to do with shoplifting, but I was playing out over and over again some kind of internal drama that I think goes something like this. I'm not getting what I deserve in life. I'm getting ripped off in some way. And so I'm going to take for myself something, even though I know it's against some sort of moral code. The trick is, Cheryl, I'm obviously thrilled by that and also plagued by guilt and shame about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I thought about this so much when I read this letter, because here is a woman who is trying to get something, in this case, compassion from the world and sympathy and understanding and unconditional love. But she is doing something that is actually guaranteed to ultimately isolate her and make her feel bad about whatever sympathy she does get.
Right. So let's hear the letter.
Yeah, let's do it. Dear Sugars, when I was 17, I told a friend that I'd been raped by a boy I met at a family beach house. This was a lie. And yet for some reason, most likely having to do with a wildly imaginative sense of self and the throes of a deep-seated and repressed depression, I lied to her. She was never a particularly good friend, and I don't feel bad about lying to her specifically, but I have found over the years that I continue to lie to people. To my college advisor when I had failed yet another semester of school, to a group of new friends on a study abroad program after a night of heavy drinking, to my current best friend and soulmate very early in our relationship. The lies have escalated and reformed a bit to fit different situations. Once it was that my high school boyfriend had committed suicide. Another time it was that I had been mildly abused during a summer fling. The situations have all been similar. I find myself in an emotionally complex place where I start to open up to people about the sadness and anxiety that hold a permanent place in my heart, or I have to account for seemingly erratic behavior, and I can't be honest. Over the past year, I've gotten better. I've started to see a therapist, and I've tried to be as honest with her as I can be. I try as much as I can to be honest with my best friend, and I usually succeed. I'm trying to live a life in accordance with what I know to be good and moral. I know that what I have done in the past is wrong, and I like to think that something inside of me has changed to realize that true connection can't be faked, and any compassion gotten through dishonest means is not real and doesn't feel good in the long run. But I have always struggled with living in the past and constant doubt and regret. How do I move forward? How do I truly become this person I see glimmers of but can't quite reach? How do I shrug off the false persona? Or do I not and learn to live with it? Signed, Wannabe Phoenix.
Wow. I just want to say first, Wannabe Phoenix, I think it was really brave for you to write to us about this. Lying, kind of like shoplifting. You know, yes. Steve started this with telling us this story about how he shoplifted throughout his life. I think this is something like lying. We're ashamed of stealing and lying, right?
Yeah.
And so before we begin, I want to say absolutely my answer to that last question you asked is like, you know, should I just accept this? Should I accept who I am, this person who lies, tells grand lies to the people closest to me? I know the answer to that is no. And not because you're a terrible person for lying. It's because lying hurts you.
You're an unhappy person. Yeah, yes. It's isolated you. And yeah,
it's clear to me that these lies are about wanting love.
And so I think this is a good way to introduce our guest, because Leslie Jamison, the author of The Empathy Exams, part of what this all boils down to is the ways in which we encode our pain in particular stories and narratives. And I think Leslie's book, The Empathy Exams, is so brilliant in a number of different ways articulating that struggle. So how do we find a narrative for our pain?
Let's give her a call.
Let's do it. Leslie?
Hi.
Hi, this is Steve Almond.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. With me in the studio here is Cheryl Strayed.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Have you had an opportunity to read this letter by Wannabe Phoenix?
I have. Yeah, totally fascinating stuff.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. So I kept thinking about this thing a therapist told me once, which was that every self-destructive behavior is trying to meet some sort of hunger or some sort of need, even if it's not meeting it in the most productive way, it's still sort of useful to think about the engine driving it as valid. And whatever in you wants compassion and attention from other people isn't, like, that's not an evil desire and it's not an invalid desire.
Right.
I mean, in every scenario that she presents, she talks about these variations on the lies, but they all center around her being a victim of something awful. And,
yeah,
you know, what she's asking for by telling this lie is protection and love and sympathy. And so maybe a way for her to reframe this is not, I'm such a terrible person because I'm always telling lies, but rather, I'm a person who hasn't received the love, protection, and sympathy that I need to thrive. And so what if she reframed this and thought, okay, how do I get sympathy, protection, and love? How do we get it?
Right, right. It's almost like in constructing all these really extreme scenarios, so many people in her life probably have their own very deeply felt, powerful versions of sadness and anxiety in them too. And it's almost like she's carving out this space of singularity for herself that actually might be pushing against what would offer her really the most consolation and comfort.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird kind of exceptionalism. And I think actually people struggle with this all the time. They feel essentially they don't have any good reason to feel anxious and sad and depressed.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
Right, right, right. Well, and depression and sadness are both really hard stories to tell. Like, they don't have narrative structures to them. There's chronic kind of nebulous conditions, so it can be hard to give a shape. I mean, I was thinking when I read this also about that David Foster Wallace short story, The Depressed Person.
Oh, yeah.
Part of why that story to me is so brilliant and actually also really compassionate is that it gets to how difficult it is to talk about depression and how exhausting it is and how exhausting it can be to hear about it as a listener, because it can get so repetitive and seem so
solipsistic, yeah.
Absolutely. But it does kind of honor that difficulty. And that's what I feel like she isn't honoring in herself.
That's right. It's sort of like depression is the chronic illness of your emotional state in the sense that people say, but really, what is it? Did something happen? I think this is really in many ways fostered by this larger idea that something terrible has to have occurred. And we've got narratives all around us in our popular culture and certainly in news and journalism. I mean, the entire way that we function now as a culture, our common narratives are all huge traumas and disasters. We just sort of skip from one to the next. And underneath all of those is the vast majority of the time, many of us are walking around in sadness and depression that is completely incomprehensible to us. I thought a lot about a couple of different books when I was reading over this letter. I thought about A Million Little Pieces, the James Frey book, and I thought, well, you know, it's so interesting because he's a really good writer, but he had to sort of gin up his life. The truth is, like our letter writer, that he felt bad about himself and probably depressed and anxious, and so he became a drug addict, and he kind of messed up his life. And that's a lot of people's stories. But in order for him to feel that he had the right to write about it and elicit sympathy and support, he had to make up, fabricate all of this extra Hollywood stuff about going to jail and, you know, make it more dire and sort of trauma-laden than it really was. But actually, the story that he set out to tell, and I think probably would have told brilliantly if he'd been willing to just put it out there, is much more common. Not I had this big, glamorous, disastrous life, but I slowly but surely ruined my life. And, you know, in a certain way, the world rewarded him for those big, elaborate lies, right?
And then the world punished him.
Yeah, absolutely. But they put him up on that pedestal. And part of what I'm getting at is I think that pressure to find some justification for an inward depression or anxiety or sadness or acting out is part of what causes people to try to gin up the trauma in their lives because they don't think it's enough to just be depressed.
Right.
Because being depressed is something shameful and there's no real reason for it and just buck up.
Right. And so, you know, a lie is a story.
Right.
It's a narrative. And I think I agree with you both entirely that I think in some ways it gives shape and form to this inexplicable anxiety and doubt that many people have and sorrow. I also think that a lie can give us a different story than the one that's actually true. And I know that this is how lies really functioned in my life. When I was a kid, I think I did lie in a pretty big way a lot throughout my childhood. The first that I can remember is when I was about 11 or 12, there were these boys who lived next door to my grandparents, and I was visiting them one summer. And I told these boys, and they lived in a much sort of middle-class, kind of wealthier neighborhood than I lived in. And I told these boys that I, as a baby, had been one of the babies on the Gerber baby food jar.
Yeah.
Okay. So I said, yes, indeed, I was one of these babies. And instead of paying me, what I got was that I get to go to college wherever I want. And that is assured. That's what I get. Like, I got a college scholarship. So I was too young.
I love it.
Isn't that crazy?
But think about it, Cheryl. It makes perfect sense.
It does.
Well, you know, you're saying to this middle class family, listen, I get to have a college education. I'm not going to be stuck in the lower classes. I'm going to get a college education.
It's really interesting for me in retrospect. You know, for a long time, I was embarrassed that I had told that lie. But now it's like, no, I was trying to really tell a different story about myself than the one that was true. Because the one that was true was sad, at least in that regard. You know, I had great ambitions. And I was telling those boys, you watch out. And so I think about Wannabe Phoenix.
Well, and once again, it's like thinking about the lie kind of as an arrow or like a signal flare or something pointing something. And in that case, part of what it was coming from was like longing or desire or like subterranean fear or something. But in all cases, it's kind of like a clue.
Yeah, I actually wanted to know, as I was reading this letter, you know, what are the lies? What lie did you tell to this person? And if you really look at those, as unpleasant as it might be, to really look at, well, what was the lie you told? There's probably a lot of clues as to what that need was that you were talking about, Leslie. What is the need that that was serving? Or what unconscious desire or fear was that lie expressing?
I was thinking about, when you were telling that story, Cheryl, I was thinking about, because I've lied many times in my life for different reasons, some of which I probably have never figured out, won't ever figure out. But one of them I was thinking about, like, when I was 21, I was dating this guy who was older, but not that much older. Like, he was maybe 28 or 29. I didn't want him to know how old I was, but I just told him I was 22 instead of 21, which is weird. Like, and I thought it was just going to be casual, but then we were really in a relationship for a while, and it came to my birthday, and then it was like this kind of,
oh my God,
moment of truth, because at that point, the lie had really become obviously a much bigger deal than the fact that I was turning 22, you know, and so I did kind of come clean, and he said absolutely that, like, I couldn't care less how old you are, but it's very strange to me that this lie just existed between us. But I did have shame about that. But I think part of it was that I did have actually these much deeper fears about, I think, being experienced enough for him and being mature enough for him. And he'd been with these other women, and would he ever love me as much as he had loved them? And somehow just the way I articulated all those fears to myself was just like wanting to be a different me. And that different me, in the case of a lie, was like a 22-year-old me rather than a 21-year-old me. But it got me started thinking too, like, at a certain point, whether the lying itself, people talk about like the familiar hell that you play, I mean, in the context of addiction a lot, but like seeking out the familiar hell, like, even if it feels really bad, it's still something that you know. And it just struck me that, like, if she's lying over and over again in these different situations, that there's almost something that started to feel like a familiar groove about that kind of shame, or like a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, I'm a person who is bad in this way, and so I'm going to keep being bad in this way, or like, this is the part of myself I hate most, so I'm going to kind of keep pushing on the bruise.
Yeah, it's like the thrill, it's a behavioral addiction in so many ways. Like, for one thing, the drama on the other side of the story, the drama when you think, I have actually been on the Gerber baby jar, or the drama when you think this woman has been the victim of a horrible crime, a rape, the drama of being a 22-year-old versus a 21-year-old.
Yeah.
And of course, like anything, like, you know, it's like any addiction, it's like there's the thrill of the high and then the shame of the come down. Leslie, like many, many people, I'm such an admirer of your work, and especially your book, The Empathy Exams. And one of the reasons we invited you on the show to talk about this particular question is I was really interested in the ways that you wrote about truth and the stories we tell about ourselves in your work, and especially in that book. And there's an essay in your book called Devil's Bait about people who have Morgellons disease. And I wondered if you could talk about that piece within the context of this letter.
Yeah. So yeah, I was thinking a lot about that piece when I read this letter, because so much of the question of that piece isn't, okay, do people who suffer from Morgellons disease actually have strange fibers coming out of their bodies, which is what they report having, or are they just making it up? Because I felt like I didn't know how to answer that question. But what I did think was interesting was why it was somehow assumed that one kind of pain was real and another kind of pain wasn't. Like, if they actually had fibers coming out of their skin, that was real pain. And if they didn't have fibers coming out of their skin, that wasn't real pain. But to me, it seemed like they were both real forms of pain. They were just different. And I was thinking about that with this letter, because it felt like, well, of course it is an incredible form of trauma to actually have gone through the things that this woman has lied about. And it's not the same to have not gone through them, but it's still a form of pain to have whatever she has inside of her that she feels like she wants to communicate. And I guess it's that sense of, sometimes it doesn't always feel very useful or compassionate to start sorting people or experiences into like valid pain and invalid pain. And this gets back to what we were saying earlier about sort of maybe trying to invite her to stop thinking so much about whether her pain is valid, to almost, I mean, I guess what I would say is like, accept that your pain is valid. And in accepting that, then claim the right to tell a truer story about it rather than fitting it into these other narratives.
Yeah, pain is part of the human condition, but how honest are we about its real sources? Right? This woman can't say, you know, I'm depressed and sad and I don't know the reasons and they're confusing to me and they might seem obscure to other people, but she can say, yeah, a couple summers ago I was raped by this boy.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I do think it is hard to figure out like how to tell the story. And like one of the moments that was really heartbreaking in her letter to me was when she's recognizing that like any compassion gotten through dishonest means is not real, because it made me feel like she was setting up these relationships where, because she had lied about something in the relationship, it was almost like she felt like she had polluted everything.
Right.
Any caring she got, she couldn't actually even experience that way.
I mean, I do think that Wannabe Phoenix really has two problems that she's presenting to us in this letter. You know, the first is this habit she has of telling terrible lies, which is a problem in and of itself, but then the profound shame that comes with being a liar. One thing I was struck by is many, many times now I have told the story, both in my books and in talking about it. I'll say, you know, my mom died and I was grieving and I used heroin and it was a way for me to heal my sorrow. You know, it wasn't the right thing to do, but I was trying to heal myself. And replace that heroin use with, I told a bunch of lies. I went around and lied to everyone I met. There would be so much more judgment. There's so much more stigma attached to being a liar than there is to being an alcoholic or using drugs or being promiscuous or any number of the other ways that we essentially get people to love us or pay attention to us. You know, I think the only way out of this is to try, you know, Wannabe Phoenix, to forgive yourself. You know, forgive yourself for the fact that this lying is the way you've chosen. It's like your addiction, but it's the way you've chosen to soothe yourself through that sorrow.
And it's engineered to make her unlovable and, you know, make her feel worthless.
Don't you think? I mean, there's like this natural judgment we have against liars in ways that maybe we don't so much anymore against people who have other ways of dealing with their problems.
Yeah, well, lying in particular, everybody does it in large and small ways. And so we're triggered by it. When we see somebody lying overtly, getting caught over and over again, pathological liar, they're really sort of off the scale of trust. Somebody is an alcoholic or they're promiscuous. Well, they're dealing with that. I don't know if there's a Liars Anonymous. You know, I think we just, at a certain point, say that person is not dependable. But that's not the tragedy. The tragedy is that they don't know and accept themselves. And so they have no hope of, you know, finding an honest path to what this woman clearly wants, which is compassion and love and concern and somebody to accept that the pain she feels is real, even if she doesn't entirely understand it or doesn't have some easy explainable cause.
Yeah, I agree with both of what you just said. And I mean, in terms of thinking about like the second huge part of her question, which is like not just what to make of this, but what to do about it or how to find some way out of it. Like, I do feel like forgiving the behavior, not in terms of thinking of it as acceptable, but thinking of it as one behavior on a whole continuum of behaviors that lots of people do. Like, yes, because lots of people lie, and also yes, because lots of people seek love and compassion in ways that hurt other people, you know, which is part of the crux here, which is, I think, part of where her guilt comes from, understandably, is that her ways of seeking sympathy have cost other people something, which is to say they worry about her, they feel pain for her, and she feels, you know, I think for good reason, like guilt about causing that pain. I think it would help for her to come clean to somebody, but she wouldn't necessarily have to think about it as like coming clean to everybody all at once. But maybe you could just start with being fully honest with one person, and that can really help ease a certain kind of burden.
Right, yeah.
Well, Leslie, we are huge fans of yours, and, you know, we're so thankful that you will, you know, came on the show and would help us sort of try to sort through these many questions that Wannabe Phoenix is struggling with.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for Wannabe Phoenix out there.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you both. Bye.